Geekscape.com.
Hello and welcome to Aryan Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and today is the 11th narration from Geoffrey of Monmouth's The History of the Kings of Britain. And today we're going to hear about Uther Pendragon becoming king. Once he had settled these matters, and others of a similar nature, Aurelius ordered Merlin to erect around the burial place the stones which he had brought from Ireland. Merlin obeyed the king's orders and put the stones up in a circle around the sepulchre in exactly the same way as they had been arranged on Mount Killaruse in Ireland, thus proving that his artistry was worth more than any brute strength. At this same time, Paschend, the son of Vortigern, who had fled to Germany, was stirring up every armed soldier in that kingdom against Aurelius Ambrosius. His great desire was to avenge his father. He promised the Germans limitless money in gold and silver, if only he could subdue Britain with their help. In the end, when he had suborned all the young men with his promises, he fitted out the greatest possible fleet, landed in the northern regions of the island, and began to lay waste to them. This was reported to the king. He summoned his own army, hastened to meet Paschend, and challenged the raging enemy to combat. They, in their turn, came out to fight and joined battle with the local inhabitants. By the grace of God, they were deprived of victory and were forced to take flight. Once he had been compelled to run away, Paschend did not dare to return to Germany. Shifting his sails, he went off to Gillemanius in Ireland and was well received by him. Gillemanius took pity on Paschend when the latter explained his misfortune. He promised Paschend help and himself complained of the injury which Uther, the brother of Aurelius, had done him too by coming to seek the giant's ring. A treaty was agreed upon between them. They fitted out ships, went on board, and then landed near the town of Menevia. As soon as this was known, a force of armed men was assembled, and Uther Pendragon set off for Cambria to fight them. His brother Aurelius was lying ill at the time in Winchester and was unable to be present. When this was made known to Paschend, Gillemanius and the Saxons who were with them, they were delighted, for they thought that with Aurelius ill, the kingdom could easily be conquered. While the people were discussing what had happened, one of the Saxons called Joppa came to Paschend. "How much will you give the man who kills Aurelius Ambrosius for you?" he asked. "If only I could find a man who was prepared to do that," answered Paschend. "I would give him 1,000 pounds of silver, and my friendship as long as I lived, if by good fortune I win the crown of this island, I will make him a captain in my army, and that I will promise on oath." "I have learned the British language," said Joppa. "I am familiar with the habits of the people, and I have some knowledge of medical practice. If only you will fulfil what you promise, then I will disguise myself as a Christian and a Briton. I will gain admittance to the king's presence by pretending to be a doctor, and I will mix for him a potion which will kill him. To enable me to gain an audience more readily, I will pretend that I am a monk, as devout as can be, and learned in all dogma." As soon as he had made this suggestion, Paschend came to an agreement with him, confirming on oath what he had already promised. Joppa thereupon shaved off his beard, had his head tonsured, took the habit of a monk, and set off for Winchester, with a load of pots which he had filled with medicines. As soon as he arrived in the town, he offered his service to the king's retainers, who received him warmly. No one could have been more welcome than a doctor. Joppa was told to come in, and they led him to the king. He promised that he would restore the king to health, if only the latter would swallow his medicines. Joppa was ordered to prepare a draught immediately. He mixed a poison and gave it to the king. Aurelius took it, drained it at a gulp, Then he was told by the accursed Ambro to snuggle down under the bed covering and to go to sleep. This so that the noisome poison could work the more efficaciously. The king immediately obeyed the advice of the man who had betrayed him and dropped off to sleep, imagining that he was about to recover his health. The poison ran quickly through his veins and the pores of his body, and thus death, which has the trick of sparing no man, came to him while he slept. Meanwhile, the accursed traitor slipped away in the crowd and was nowhere to be found in the court. While these things were happening at Winchester, there appeared a star of great magnitude and brilliance, with a single beam shining from it. At the end of this beam was a ball of fire spread out in the shape of a dragon. From the dragon's mouth stretched forth two rays of light, one of which seemed to extend its length beyond the latitude of Gaul, while the second turned towards the Irish Sea and split up into seven smaller shafts of light. This star appeared three times, and all who saw it were struck with fear and wonder. Uther, the king's brother, who was hunting for the enemy army, was just as terrified as the others. He summoned his wise men so that they might tell him what the star portended. He ordered Merlin to be fetched with the others, for Merlin had come with the army so that the campaign could have the benefit of his advice. As he stood in the presence of his leader and was given the order to explain the significance of the star, he burst into tears, summoned up his familiar spirit, and prophesied aloud. "Our loss is irreparable," he said. "The people of Britain is orphaned. Our most illustrious king has passed away. Aurelius Ambrosius, the famous king of the Britons, has died. By his death, we shall all die, unless God brings us help. Hasten forward, most noble leader, hasten forward, Uther, and do not put off for a moment making contact with the enemy. Victory shall be yours, and you will be king of all Britain. The star signifies you in person, and so does the fiery dragon beneath the star. The beam of light which stretches towards the shore of Gaul signifies your son, who will be a most powerful man. His dominion shall extend over all the kingdoms which the beam covers. The second ray signifies your daughter, whose sons and grandsons shall hold one after the other the kingship of Britain." Although he remained in some doubt whether or not what Merlin had prophesied was true, Uther nevertheless continued to advance against the enemy as he had begun. He had now come within half a day's march of Menevia. As soon as his approach was announced to Gillemanius, Paschent and the Saxons who were there, they marched out to meet him and do battle with him. The moment the armies came in sight of each other, they drew up their lines of battle on either side, marched forward to make contact, and so began the fight. As usually happens in such a combat, soldiers were slain on both sides as they fought. In the end, when much of the day had passed, Uther proved the stronger and won the victory, killing Gillemanius and Paschent in the process. The barbarians turned in flight and ran to their ships, and in their retreat they were cut down by the islanders who pursued them. By the grace of Christ, victory thus came to our leader. After this great undertaking, Uther set out for Winchester with all possible speed. Messengers who came to meet him told him of the king's death, saying that Aurelius was soon to be buried by the bishops of the country near the monastery of Ambrius and inside the giant's ring, the construction of which he had himself ordered during his lifetime. When they heard of his death, the bishops, abbots, and all the clergy of that diocese had assembled in the town of Winchester. They arranged his funeral in a way becoming to so great a king, since, while still alive, he had ordained that he should be put to rest in the cemetery which he had himself prepared. They bore his body thither and buried him there with royal pomp. Uther, the brother of Aurelius, convened the clergy and the people of his kingdom and took into his safe keeping the crown of the island. With the agreement of everyone present, he was appointed king. Mindful of the explanation given by Merlin, of the star about which I have told you, he ordered two dragons to be fashioned in gold, in the likeness of the one which he had seen in the ray which shone from that star. As soon as the dragons had been completed, and this with the most marvellous craftsmanship, he made a present of one of them to the congregation of the Cathedral Church of the See of Winchester. The second one he kept for himself, so that he could carry it around to his wars. From that moment onwards, he was called Uther Pendragon, which in the British language means a dragon's head. He had been given this title because it was by means of a dragon, and Merlin had prophesied that he would become king. Meanwhile, Octa, the son of Hengist, and his kinsman, Eosa, considering themselves freed from the treaty which they had made with Aurelius Ambrosius, did everything they could to harass the king and to overrun his dominions. They started by allying to themselves those Saxons whom Paschent had brought over, and then they sent their messengers to Germany to summon the rest of them. Octa put himself in the centre of this huge army and invaded the northern provinces. He went on satiating his lust for cruelty until he had destroyed all the towns and strong points from Albany as far as York. Finally, just as he had begun to besiege that town, Uther Pendragon arrived with the entire strength of his kingdom and met Octa in a pitched battle. The Saxons resisted manfully. They remained unbroken in the face of the assaults by the Britons, and in the end they drove their enemy back in flight. Having once gained the victory, they pursued the Britons as far as Mount Damon, continuing as long as the sun gave light to see by. This hill was a steep one. On its summit it had a hazel wood, and halfway up there were jagged rocks well suited to be the lairs of wild animals. The Britons occupied the hill and spent the night among these rocks and hazel bushes. Then, as the plough began to revolve its pole, Uther ordered his leaders and princes to be summoned to him, so that with their advice he might decide how they could attack the enemy. They all came together in the king's presence, and he ordered them to say what they advised. He asked Gulwar, the Duke of Cornwall, a man of great experience and mature years, to give his opinion first. "This is no moment," said Gulwar, "for chattering or empty beating about the bush. While we see that some of the night still remains, we must act boldly and bravely. That is, if we expect any longer to enjoy either life or liberty. The numerical strength of the pagans is very great, and they are spoiling for a fight. We, on the other hand, have far fewer men. If we once wait for day to dawn, I see no point in our attacking them at all. Let us move, then. While the darkness lasts, we must clamber down in close formation and surprise them in their camp by the very unexpectedness of our attack. Without any shadow of a doubt, we shall triumph over them, if only we attack them altogether in the boldest possible fashion, for they will not have foreseen anything of this sort, nor will they have expected us to attack in this way." The advice of Gulwar pleased the king, and all the others too, and they carried out his suggestions. As soon as they were armed and drawn up in companies, they set out for the enemy's camp, with the intention of mounting a mass assault. But as they moved forward, the sentinels observed their coming, and awakened their comrades, who were sound asleep, by blowing on their cornets. The enemy were surprised and thrown into confusion. Some of them rushed to arm themselves, and others were so terrified that they ran off in whatever direction the impulse of the moment suggested to them. The Britons moved forward in close formation, and soon came to the camp itself. They charged forward with drawn swords, located the gateway, and rushed in among the enemy. Engaged as they were, at a moment when they least expected it, the enemy offered no effectual resistance. Our own men, on the other hand, became more and more bold as they saw their plans succeeding. The Britons made every effort to press forward eagerly. They butchered the pagans with might and main, killing off some thousands of them. In the end, Octa and Eosa were captured, and the Saxons were completely routed. After this victory, Uther went to the town called Alclud, and while there, he settled the affairs of that region and restored peace everywhere. Then he visited all the lands of the Scots and reclaimed that rebellious people from their state of savagery, for he administered justice throughout the regions in a way that none of his predecessors had been able to do. In his time, those who had committed any crime were greatly terrified, for they were punished mercilessly. When he had finally pacified the northern provinces, he moved to London. He ordered Octa and Eosa to be kept in prison there. The next Eastertide, Uther told the nobles of his kingdom to assemble in that same town of London so that he could wear his crown and celebrate so important a feast day with proper ceremony. They all obeyed, travelling in from their various cities and assembling on the eve of the feast. The king was thus able to celebrate the feast as he had intended, and to enjoy himself in the company of his leaders. They too were all happy, seeing that he had received them with such affability. A great many nobles had gathered there, men worthy of taking part in such a gay festivity, together with their wives and daughters. Among the others there was present Gulwar, Duke of Cornwall, with his wife Egerna, who was the most beautiful woman in Britain. When the king saw her, there among the other women, he was immediately filled with desire for her, with the result that he took no notice of anything else, but devoted all his attention to her. To her and to no one else, he kept ordering plates of food to be passed, and to her too he kept sending his own personal attendants with golden goblets of wine. He kept smiling at her and engaging her in sprightly conversation. When Egerna's husband saw what was happening, he was so annoyed that he withdrew from the court without taking leave. No one present could persuade him to return, for he was afraid of losing the one object that he loved better than anything else. Uther lost his temper and ordered Gulwar to come back to court so that he, the king, could seek satisfaction for the way in which he had been insulted. Gulwar refused to obey. The king was furious and swore an oath that he would ravage Gulwar's lands unless the latter gave him immediate satisfaction. Without more ado, while the bad blood remained between the two of them, the king collected a huge army together and hurried off to the Duchy of Cornwall, where he set fire to towns and castles. Gulwar's army was the smaller of the two, and he did not dare to meet the king in battle. He preferred instead to garrison his castles and to bide his time until he could receive help from Ireland. As he was more worried about his wife than he was about himself, he left her in the castle of Tintagel, on the sea coast, which he thought was the safest place under his control. He himself took refuge in a fortified camp called Dimilioch, so that, if disaster overtook them, they should not both be endangered together. When the king heard of this, he went to the encampment where Gulwar was, besieged it, and cut off every line of approach. Finally, after a week had gone by, the king's passion for Egerna became more than he could bear. He called to him Ulfin of Rhydcaradoc, one of his soldiers and a familiar friend, and told him what was on his mind. "I am desperately in love with Egerna," said Uther, "and if I cannot have her, I am convinced that I shall suffer a physical breakdown. You must tell me how I can satisfy my desire for her, for otherwise I shall die of the passion which is consuming me." "Who can possibly give you useful advice," answered Ulfin, "when no power on earth can enable us to come to her, where she is inside the fortress of Tintagel? The castle is built high above the sea, which surrounds it on all sides, and there is no other way in except that offered by a narrow isthmus of rock. Three armed soldiers could hold it against you, even if you stood there with the whole kingdom of Britain at your side. If only the prophet Merlin would give his mind to the problem, then, with his help, I think you might be able to obtain what you want." The king believed Ulfin, and ordered Merlin to be sent for he too had come to the siege. Merlin was summoned immediately. When he appeared in the king's presence, he was ordered to suggest how the king could have his way with Igerna. When Merlin saw the torment which the king was suffering because of this woman, he was amazed at the strength of his passion. "If you are to have your wish," he said, "you must make use of methods which are quite new, and until now unheard of in your day. By my drugs, I know how to give you the precise appearance of Gulwar, so that you will resemble him in every respect. If you do what I say, I will make you exactly like him, and Ulfin exactly like Gulwar's companion, Jordan of Tintagel. I will change my own appearance too, and come with you. In this way, you will be able to go safely to Igerna in her castle, and be admitted." The king agreed, and listened carefully to what he had to do. In the end, he handed the siege over to his subordinates, took Merlin's drugs, and was changed into the likeness of Gulwar. Ulfin was changed into Jordan, and Merlin into a man called Britalis, so that no one could tell what they had previously looked like. They then set off for Tintagel, and came to the castle in the twilight. The moment the guard was told that his leader was approaching, he opened the gates and the men were let in. Who indeed could possibly have suspected anything once it was thought that Gulwar himself had come? The king spent that night with Igerna and satisfied his desire by making love with her. He had deceived her by the disguise which he had taken. He had deceived her too by the lying things that he said to her, things which he planned with great skill. He said that he had come out secretly from his besieged encampment so that he might make sure that all was well with her, whom he loved so dearly, and with his castle too. She naturally believed all that he said, and refused him nothing that he asked. That night she conceived Arthur, the most famous of men, who subsequently won great renown by his outstanding bravery. Meanwhile, when it was discovered at the siege of Dimilioc that the king was no longer present, his army, acting without his instructions, tried to breach the walls and challenge the beleaguered duke to battle. The duke, equally ill-advisedly, sallied forth with his men, imagining, apparently, that he could resist such a host of armed men with his own tiny band. As the struggle between them swayed this way and that, Gulwar was among the first to be killed. His men were scattered, and the besieged camp was captured. The treasure which had been deposited there was shared out in the most inequitable way, for each man seized in his greedy fist whatever good luck and his own brute strength threw in his way. Not until the outrages which followed this daring act had finally subsided did messengers come to Igerna to announce the death of the duke and the end of the siege. When they saw the king sitting beside Igerna in the likeness of their leader, they blushed red with astonishment to see that the man whom they had left behind dead in the siege had in effect arrived there safely before them. Of course, they did not know of the drugs prepared by Merlin. The king put his arms around the duchess and laughed aloud to hear these reports. "I am not dead," he said. "Indeed, as you see, I am very much alive. However, the destruction of my camp saddens me very much, and so does the slaughter of my comrades. What is more, there is great danger that the king may come this way and capture us in this castle. I will go out to meet him and make peace with him, lest even worse should befall us." The king set out and made his way towards his own army, abandoning his disguise as Gulwar and becoming Uther Pendragon once more. When he learned all that had happened, he mourned for the death of Gulwar, but he was happy all the same that Igerna was freed from her marital obligations. He returned to Tintagel Castle, captured it, and seized Igerna at the same time, she being what he really wanted. From that day on, they lived together as equals, united by their great love for each other, and they had a son and a daughter. The boy was called Arthur, and the girl, Anna. As the days passed and lengthened into years, the king fell ill with a malady which affected him for a long time. Meanwhile, the prison warders who guarded Octa and Yosa as I have explained above, led a weary life. In the end, they escaped with their prisoners to Germany, and in doing so, terrified the kingdom. For rumour had it that they had already stirred up Germany, and had fitted out a huge fleet in order to return to the island and destroy it. This, indeed, actually happened. They came back with an immense fleet and more men than could ever be counted. They invaded certain parts of Albany, and busied themselves in burning the cities there, and the citizens inside them. The British army was put under the command of Loath of Lodonesia, with orders that he should keep the enemy at a distance. This man was one of the leaders, a valiant soldier, mature both in wisdom and age. As a reward for his prowess, the king had given him his daughter Anna, and put him in charge of the kingdom, while he himself was ill. When Loath moved forward against the enemy, he was frequently driven back again by them, so that he had to take refuge inside the cities. On other occasions he routed and dispersed them, forcing them to fly, either into the forests or to their ships. Between the two sides, the outcome of each battle was always in doubt, it being hard to tell which of them was victorious. Their own arrogance was a handicap to the Britons, for they were unwilling to obey the orders of their leaders. This undermined their strength, and they were unable to beat the enemy in the field. Almost all the island was laid waste. When this was made known to the king, he fell into a greater rage than he could really bear in his weakened state. He told all his leaders to appear before him, so that he could rebuke them for their overweening pride and their feebleness. As soon as he saw them all assembled in his presence, he reproached them bitterly, and swore that he himself would lead them against the enemy. He ordered a litter to be built, so that he could be carried in it, for his weakness made any other form of progress impossible. Then he instructed them all to be in a state of preparedness, so that they could advance against the enemy, as soon as the opportunity offered. The litter was constructed immediately, the men were made ready to start, and the opportunity duly came. They put the king in his litter and set out for St. Albans, where the Saxons I have told you about were maltreating all the local population. When Octa and Eosa were informed of the Britons' arrival and of the fact that their king had been brought along in a litter, they were too proud to fight him, on the grounds that he had to be carried there. According to them, Uther was already half dead, and it was not decent for such great men as themselves to fight with a person in that state. They thereupon retired into the town, leaving the gates wide open to show that they were not afraid of him. When this was reported to Uther, he immediately ordered the city to be besieged, and an assault to be made on the walls from every side. The Britons obeyed him, investing the city and attacking its walls. They slaughtered some few of the Saxons, breached the walls, and would have entered if the Saxons had not finally begun to resist. The Britons were now having the best of it, so that the Saxons repented of their former arrogance and decided to defend themselves wherever they could. They climbed onto the top of the walls and drove the Britons back with every weapon they could lay hands on. As the two sides fought each other, night came on, inviting them all to lay down their arms and rest. Many needed this repose, but the majority preferred some plan by which they could destroy their enemies. When the Saxons realized what harm their arrogance had done them, for the Britons had been on the point of winning a victory, they determined to sally forth at daybreak and challenge their enemies to a pitched battle in the open field. That, indeed, is what they did. As soon as the rising sun heralded the day, they marched out, company by company, thus putting their plan into operation. As soon as the Britons saw this, they divided their own men into companies and made the first attack. The Britons advanced, and the Saxons stood their ground. Great slaughter was done on both sides. In the end, when the day was far advanced, the king of the Britons was victorious. Octa and Eosa were killed, and the Saxons turned tail. So overjoyed was the king at what had happened, that although he had previously been unable to lift himself up without the support of someone else, he now sat up straight in his litter after a little effort, and suddenly seemed to recover his health. "The Ambrinese used to call me the half-dead king," he said, and burst out laughing as he spoke. "That was because I lay flat in my litter, greatly reduced as I was by my illness. Half-dead indeed I really was, but I would rather be half-dead and beat them than safe and sound, with a full expectation of life, and be beaten by them. Death with honour means more to me than living on in disgrace."
Radioarian.com.